This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Taping from the cafe at AS220 in Down City, Providence, Rhode Island, home of Triple Deckers, Artists and Lofts, and the confluence of the not-quite-so-mighty Winnisquituckett and Providence Rivers. Today our topic is the 20th anniversary of the first critical mass ride, a bicycle demonstration or protest that helped change what and how we protested while forcing us to ask who had the right to the city and why. With me today to help us look at the history and contemporary ramification of critical mass are Nicole Friedman, former Olympian, 3 times national champion road cyclist, and former director of bicycle programs for the city of Boston. David V. Herlihy, an author and historian, and well known for the writing Bicycle, the History and Lost Cyclist, the epic trail of an American adventurer and his mysterious disappearance. And Zach Furness, assistant professor of communications, Penn State, Greater Allegheny, and the author of the fascinating and provocative One Less Car, Bicycling and the Politics of Automobility. Welcome to Action Speaks, all of you. I know you've come from different places, some up in Boston and Maine and Pittsburgh.
That's right.
Wonderful to have you here. So can you tell me, Zach, what Critical Mass is?
Critical Mass is, as you pointed out, it was an event started 20 years ago. The idea was first proposed by a group of people who kind of ranged from bike advocates to messengers, other activists and people that were living in San Francisco, some of whom had started sort of informal thing called the commute clot, with the idea being to get a bunch of folks together and try to ride home safely. And to do it once a month and to give people a way who were cyclists to actually have a point of identification, to know other people were out there riding, and to also try to do something to call public attention to it at the same time. And then around the time that this was getting started, some people had screened a film. And in the film, there was it's a film called Return of the Scorcher. There's a scene in there where they're filming bike culture in China. And there's a scene where they're showing pedestrian crossing and all the automobiles stop while a huge group of people got together and crossed. And a guy named George Bliss, who was the bike maker from New York, who was talking about it, referred to it as a critical mass. And so people took the term and used that to name the thing that they had started doing in San Francisco. And it caught on steam pretty quickly, and then it soon spread to what became over 300 cities throughout the world.
Nicole, Zach said a critical word, to coin a phrase, about safety. Was that a problem in Boston with bicycles when you first got to be the, as they call it, the Boston Tsar, or as you call it, the Tsarina?
Safety is always an issue, and when you work for a city, safety is the number one concern of transportation. But when the mayor started the bike programs in Boston, it was really that Boston was the worst cycling city in the country. We even had an international award as worst cycling city in the world.
I think it's the worst driving city, though, myself. I get lost every time I get there.
I'll tell you, living in Maine, I miss Boston drivers. Sometimes I have to go to the nearest stoplight 30 miles away and start honking and swearing at people. But so for Boston, it was really, how do we promote cycling, catch up with the rest of the country, rest of the world, and turn around Boston? Safety, of course, was a big component of that.
And David Hurley, there's a certain irony in the fact that a lot of the roads were originally paved for bicycles. Am I right?
That's true. The cyclists were really the force that launched the Good Roads movement.
But isn't that a strange irony that the roads that were built for bicycles are now taken over by cars? What happened to the power of the bicyclists? After all, if you can actually lobby your city, federal, state governments to build roads, you must have had a lot of power in the 1890s. And then something happened.
The boom went bust, basically. So the great, you know, the golden age of cycling in the 1890s. Sometimes people think, I think mistakenly, that it was the automobile that ended that. And it really wasn't, because you didn't have affordable automobiles that early. But the League of American Wheelmen, which was kind of the lobbying group, pretty much disintegrated.
Which started in?
In Newport, Rhode Island. That's absolutely true. So, yeah, there was not a cohesive group at a certain point to defend cycling rights. And then, you know, when automobiles did come along, they basically overpowered the few cyclists who were there. So it's,
and all of a sudden, the automobile becomes the king and queen of the road. What happened? Why all of a sudden did our urban life begin to be determined by and for the cars?
Well, I mean, there are a variety of reasons. I mean, part of it is that Ford cut the price of cars in half in the 20s, so cars became more affordable. You had places like Chicago and a number of other cities that were sort of reorganized with plans in mind by people who really liked driving. Daniel Burnham was a big fan of the car, and some of the work that he did in Chicago around urban planning, he was also used as a consultant in various parts of the country. So their experience of the city was one that was informed a lot by looking through the windshield, basically. I think also people's interest in all the kinds of things that get wrapped up with driving that are in many ways quite real. I mean, the fact that you can have folks that can get from the country to the city easily. A lot of things that were once very difficult that are made easier, whether it's hauling things, carrying children around, all of those things, I think, put together. And then a lot of that really starts to get cemented about the middle of the 20th century when you start to have the construction of really enormous highways, which, of course, happened earlier in, you know, the parts of the East Coast in Pennsylvania where you do have highways well before that, but, you know, a real massive concerted effort to sort of really push transportation in that way permanently, both with funding and, you know, with the actual material that you build things out of.
I find it interesting when I read about this subject that people talk about the way in which the automobile began to basically control the physical space of the city. And having grown up in New York with the kind of the, not the bicycle czar, but the automobile and construction czar, Robert Moses, I understand that, where all of a sudden large swaths of neighborhoods, walkable neighborhoods, public transportation-oriented neighborhoods, were taken over by highways. And the automobile became the exclusive owner of those particular spaces. So my idea must be with this is that somehow there was some sort of rebellion by bicycles, and whether it's a conscious rebellion or just simply saying we have to take ownership again of these roads, something must have happened at some particular time that began to tip the balance or at least change the paradigm of who should have the rights to the city. Am I correct about that, Nicole?
Well, I think the movement's been building, and you look at cycling and it's really at the nexus of public health and environmentalism and a little bit of local economy. But, you know, knowledge of climate change and global warming is on the rise, literally. And obviously public health is sort of in a crisis, and that really, you know, has opened people's eyes to cycling. And I think the last 5 years we've really seen, at least nationally, a huge boon in attention to cycling and cities really trying to reclaim their infrastructure.
David Hurley, in the early days, bicycles were really part of the kind of the good health movement of the turn of the 20th century, wasn't it? There was sort of an attempt to be athletic and be interested in the rural parts of the world rather than the urban world. Am I correct?
Absolutely,
with that?
Yeah. The from the very start, going back, you know, when the first bicycles in the 1860s, even. That was part of the promise, the idea that you could get on, you know, your bicycle and head out and get some fresh air. And it was definitely a big part of the bicycle boom, the idea of the recognition that we need to exercise.
So the bicycle comes in and basically provides freedom in some ways. But some would say it also provided sort of the not only the physical space for the cars, but set in motion in our heads an idea that we should be able to get from one house to the other rather than going on a public transportation system. So it sort of challenged us in new ways, didn't it, Zach?
Yeah, biking did, I think, organize to a sense how people related to public space, how they thought about their own relationship to machines, The kind of ways that people, I think, borrowed from their relationship to the sort of credibility and esteem they had for, like, horses. And, I mean, even the terms that people use, like saddles and other things that sort of alluded to this relationship to horseback, to getting around. But there's all these kinds of things that I think in the period that are both about transportation but also about people's dispositions towards public space. I'm not trying to make the argument that bicycling is the thing solely responsible for that, but I think it's a really easy way to see how a lot of things that you might otherwise call sort of cultural or structural sort of fit together in the way that people start to get interested in riding.
I have a question from the audience. Your name and where you're from?
My name is Mike, and I'm from Providence. I'm curious about the cultural aspects of bicycling, because in the United States, we seem to have a very different bicycle culture than in many places elsewhere, and especially overseas. Why is it that our bicycling culture is so radically different than it is in, say, Great Britain or China or anywhere else, really?
Nicole?
I could speak on the U.S. culture. In the bike planning world, a lot of who is biking is very much dependent on what the streets are like. So they talk about right now who would go bike in a street that has no bike lanes and lots of cars. And it's probably 1% of the population. We call them sort of fearless. They're going to go out and bike absolutely no matter what. And then you look at a city like Portland, and they got up to about 7% of trips made by bike. And the truth, though, is if you pull the population, about 50% of the people would say they want to bike, but and they're afraid for safety and security, and they're mostly afraid of the cars. So as you make the streets safer, you'll get more people out there. After the 7%, if you start putting in protected bike lanes, you might get up to 30% of the population biking. That's what you see in Copenhagen now. And then in the U.S., we have a population of about 60% that is the no way, no how, no matter what we do, they're never going to bike. I put my dad in that category. I bought him a bike for his 60th birthday, and he handed it back 3 months later, said, sell this thing. I'm never going to ride that bicycle again. But one thing you see, we just launched Bike Share in Boston. It's now in Minneapolis, D.C., San Antonio, I think. All of a sudden, you're getting the average person or the mainstream person on a bike. And we saw that happen in Paris. It was just like a U.S. city when they launched in 2008. Within 2 years, they had 54 million trips taken by bicycle. We're seeing the same phenomenon here. So you're seeing women on bikes and men in suits. Women are called the indicator species. I think men in suits are a pretty good indicator species, too.
We'll be back in a second. I'm Mark Levitt, and you're listening to Action Speaks, Underappreciated 20th Century Dates That Changed America. You can read more about the topics we're discussing, friend us, and our comment on our show at our website, actionspeaksradio.org, where we have an interview with the founder of Critical Mass, Chris Carlson. We're funded in part by the law firm of Robinson & Cole, LLP. Hi, and welcome back. I'm Mark Levitt, and today on Action Speaks, we're talking about the 1992 first critical mass ride, the ride that changed the nature of protest while challenging the automobile's de facto monopoly of the street. Our thanks to the National Endowment for the Humanities and to the Rhode Island Council for the Humanities for their generous support. Our panelists today are Nicole Friedman, former competitive cyclist, and Boston's former well-regarded bike czar. David V. Herlihy, author of Bike, A Wonderful History of the Bicycle, and Zach Furness, author of the fascinating and provocative One Less Car, Bicycling and the Politics of Automobility. We have a question from the audience. Give us your name, where you're from, and for you, I know, give us what you do.
Okay. My name's Jack Madden. I'm from Providence. I own Legend Bicycle over on the east side. To the other gentleman's question about American politicians, there are a couple in Washington that do ride their bikes. One is from Portland, Oregon. A couple, I'm not really sure. And the Washington, D.C. bike share is very well used. I think the Washington, D.C. bike share is a really thing to keep an eye on. My question is, what will it take in this country for whether it's bicycling or transit to become a serious political issue where on the same level as healthcare reform, will there ever be a transportation reform that gets debated at the national level that will influence funding and infrastructure and, you know, all the things that affect the future of transportation?
Nicole, as someone who worked where the proverbial rubber hit the road, what were the impediments to creating a system of transportation where bicycles had their place along with and comparable to public transportation and the automobile?
I think it's a great question. In many ways, the city was out in front of the general public, and I've seen that in a lot of the other progressive cities that are pro-cycling. And a great example in Boston is Massachusetts Avenue. It's has about the highest number of vehicles, ADT, per day. And at the same time, in Boston, it had the highest number of cycling accidents per year, you know, off the charts. And the mayor wanted to put in a bike lane on that street. To put in a bike lane on that street, we had to remove 70 parking spaces. In Boston, if you don't know, parking is a constitutional right. And the mayor said, we're going to do this, and yet it was still many, many months of public meetings and a lot of opposition by the public. And ultimately, I'd stand up and I'd say, how are you going to weigh a cyclist's life against a parking spot? Because that really was the question. And a couple weeks before we put in that bike lane, there actually was a cyclist killed on Mass Ave. It was in Cambridge, not Boston. But it was a given there would be a cyclist seriously injured or killed. And still, people love their cars, they love their parking. It's going to take all of us and the general public to really rethink what we want our country to be like and how we want our cities and suburbs to function.
David, you wrote a book on the history of bicycling. Will that history, from your point of view, include its transcendence into a place where it is equal? And how will it develop that equal to the automobile as a means to transit from one place to the other for work or for shopping?
Well, I think what we're seeing is a rebirth of the idea that that at least it's an alternative form of transportation. You know, there was a notion for a long time in this country that cars were or bicycles were basically for children. Of course, the Europeans have been smarter about that, getting back to some of the differences. They've understood more consistently than we have. I mean, the bicycle's always been part of their culture. We've had these kind of ups and downs where the bikes disappeared pretty much from adult use, whereas in Europe and other places, it's been consistently recognized as a smart alternative in many cases, especially in the city, for transportation. So I think it's not necessarily about replacing the car, but creating an infrastructure where it has, you know, it's reasonably safe, as Nicole alluded to. I mean, that's critical. It's, you know, to get more people on bicycles, there has to be an infrastructure in place so that they feel and are safer riding bicycles. But, you know, logistically, it makes a lot of sense because bicycles really are, in many cases, the most efficient way to get around the city. So I think we're seeing a lot of improvement lately, and hopefully that will continue.
Nicole?
Most directly to his point, though, he asked, what will it take for politicians to believe in cycling? Copenhagen is the best model. 1970s gas crisis. Their response was, oh my God, this is going to happen over and over and over again. We need to address it. We need to address it now. They push cycling. They're at 30% mode split now. They're going to go up to 50%. When I look at gas prices in the United States, they're high right now. They'll go up and down and up and down, but they're definitely going up. We're past, I don't know what it's called, the critical peak, or, you know, gas prices are only going up forever. And, you know, that's a significant alternative.
You think they'll go up too? I always notice, does everybody notice this? I always notice that they go up and then they go down a little bit. You're sort of used to, you go, oh, I'm so happy it's 389 now. And then it goes up again. And then it goes, it creates a new normal. Every time there's a new normal about these gas prices.
The most effective thing you can do is have massive spikes. So you want the shock value. Well, I guess if you want to promote cycling, you want the shock value. I guess I should never run for any kind of office, but I'm sure that this will be one of the ads against me if I ever do.
That's right. Politician promotes spike in gas prices. We have a question from the audience. Tell us your name and where you're from, please.
My name's Jocelyn. I'm from Providence. In regards to bike safety, I was wondering how you would deal with the bicyclist who feels they don't have to pay attention to red lights or any street sign that's out there. Granted, the car should be aware of the bicyclist, but the bicyclist should be aware of the cars.
That's an interesting question. I want to ask you, David, doesn't it have a history of when all of a sudden the bicyclist decided to conform to certain rules and what that meant in terms of sort of disciplining the population to understand certain kinds of civic duties that they had when they were riding bicycles?
Right. Well, you know, the term scorcher that you mentioned earlier, that dates back to the 1890s, and that was, of course, you know, the speedsters and the ones who sort of defied the rules, so to speak. I mean, I think there were rules, if I remember right, something like maybe you couldn't go faster than 10 miles an hour. You know, at one point you had cops trying to crack down on scorchers, but they were having a hard time because they couldn't keep up with them. So some cities started to give the cops bicycles so they could chase down the scorchers. And, you know, so, yeah, it's part of the, I guess, the problem when you promote cycling, you know, it's like driving a car. I mean, how do you discipline, or how do you, should you try to punish those who don't obey the rules? I mean, it's one of the issues that I guess that comes up with critical mass too. Yeah,
I mean, I think that it's really hard to get anyone to follow rules when it comes to transportation. I think that for me, I mean, I don't know the exact strategies that work best. There's a lot of ways that people have tried to do it. I think mainly focusing on the kind of incentives for people to, like, you know, to really think about the issues that it can cause for people who are pedestrians. I personally also, like, I mean, as a kind of adjunct to the question, I think people tend to focus on it a lot. I think people really love to talk about the things that cyclists don't do on the road. Like, if bike riders run red lights, it's like the end of the world. And I'm not trying to discount the fact that that can be a serious problem, but I think that, I mean, whether people have done studies on this where they've, you know, looked at folks that watch clips of people and driving behaviors, and they get irate at what the cyclists do, regardless of whether, and they sort of justify their own behavior depending on, you know, if they're in a car or not. And I think that we get used to seeing things in a way where, I think because cyclists are so exposed and we do these kinds of things where it gets really, I think it's annoying for drivers, and I think that's more the frustration that comes from the end of where that critique is. And to me, I think those are the kinds of things that people need to also sort of keep in check, along with actually promoting, you know,
but even
people,
in critical,
people to ride safely.
Even in critical, you know, mass rides, Chris Carlson, in his interview with me, said that there are occasionally what he calls testosterone brigades.
Yeah, totally.
Where what happened is the anger of the bicycle riders at the automobiles got boiled up to the point where there was bashing windows and hitting.
I think particularly with critical mass, you have, I mean, even like I know, you know, I've anarchist friends in Philadelphia who played in really loud, aggressive bands that wouldn't go to critical mass because they thought it got like too rowdy, you know? So, and it's not because it was a violent scene or anything, but they didn't like the tone of it because despite the kind of loud, you know, things that they were into and the fact that they were really into riding bikes, they still recognized that it wasn't the kind of way that they wanted that to get translated. And it, in the same way in San Francisco, it would draw people that wanted to use it as a moment to like tell drivers what they thought about them, as opposed to it being something that was about celebrating actually riding.
Like you said, there's other sides of critical mass that we're going to get into. Yeah, Nicole, before that question that you wanted to ask, answer or ask.
So how do you promote cyclists following the rules of the road? Number one, you have to build facilities for cyclists. So if you start with Naked City with no bike facilities, the cyclists are going to run the red lights. One, because you've got the most aggressive of the aggressive personalities out there, and two, because to them there are no rules. Once you put in the bike lanes, you can say, look, we've legitimized your presence on the road. You need to follow the rules of the road. The other thing that's very powerful, and cyclists are a very cohesive group, once you get to that point, you can say, look, if we want to continue moving forward, promoting cyclists, putting in more bike facilities, we need to win over public support. And by running the red lights, cyclists erode all that public support. It's a true argument, and it's powerful, and it's a way for cyclists to work within themselves and say, we need to change this because we can't request that the city remove 70 parking spots or remove a travel lane if people hate us.
So demarginalizing and finding common denominator.
Sure, that's so much quicker, too, than what I just said.
Yeah, I always take a car in my mind rather than bicycle, unfortunately. Yes, name and where you're from.
Terry Cannon from Providence. Back in the 60s, I lived off-grid in Canada. Town was like 10 miles away, and my nearest neighbor was about 4 miles away. And I lived on $3 a week, but I had a bicycle. So I can get to town, pick up a few things every few weeks. I come back to the city in the 60s, and there was nothing happening with bicycles. There were no bicycles in Providence. I was the only bicycle rider, it felt like. And it was really kind of great, the only adult bicycle rider in the streets. I liked anyone who knows anything about Kabouter in Amsterdam, the zebra bikes, the black and white painted bikes that people would leave anywhere. They just ride them and leave them. And I hear there's something recently in New York City where you pay $60 a year. So anyone who knows more about that, I'd like to hear about that.
The public, I mean, they have a variety of different names, but like the public use bicycle programs that people had mentioned earlier, and their initial form of them do come from Amsterdam. And they came from a group of anarchist sort of rabble-rousers in the 1960s that were under the name the Provo. It was started, they had all these sort of outrageous plans for things they were going to do in Amsterdam. One of them was the White Bicycle Plan, and they demanded that the city buy 20,000 bicycles for public use and that they forbid cars from driving in Amsterdam, which of course the police weren't fond of. And so the idea was to have bikes that anyone could use and that no one could use, and they were sort of to be this critique of capitalist private property where anyone could use them and you wouldn't have to pay. But they were also a way to promote cycling and a way to try to cut down on air pollution. And it was part of a sort of broader wave of folks that were making bikes a political thing, which is part of the reason why, as Nicole spoke to in Copenhagen, people's response was a political response in the 70s, and to make cycling an issue. And the same thing happened in Amsterdam. Part of it came from that energy from those folks. And there were people who did a range of different programs after that, but then that really caught steam as a more formal, organized kind of thing. But Lud Schimmelpenninck, one of the people involved really early on, helped to start one of the first programs like
but
that.
But it does speak to this issue that even in Amsterdam, cars were kings and queens for a while. So they had ups and downs. Even though early on bicycles were important in Amsterdam, there was a point after the war where cars became symbols of modernity, symbols of consumption, symbols of success for that time in the post-war period. And this was a response to that, what people perceived of as the taking over of the city, of those kinds of philosophical values as well as transportation alternatives.
Yeah, absolutely.
David, is the history of bicycle histories of these kinds of protests and these kinds of ways in which the bicycle, instead of in the early days being understood as sort of a way of healthily engaging with the world, became later on something that we had to protest, something that we had to demand a right for?
I mean, it's really two kinds of riding we're talking about. There's recreational riding, and then there's utilitarian. And so, you know, in the early part of the century, when cars start taking over the roads, it's a problem if you're a cyclist and you want to go out and enjoy the countryside. You don't, you know, you don't breathe the fresh air anymore, and you run off the road. And you know, but then the idea of the bicycle as a utilitarian vehicle, you know, that. It kind of clung to that niche in a way in the early part of the 20th century because there were still people who couldn't afford automobiles. And so, you know, they were still relying on bicycles. But that you had lost the kind of, you know, the cohesiveness we talked about. The LAW is pretty much disintegrated. And so there are a lot of lone cyclists out there. And I think it's taken a long time to see really organized efforts to kind of for cyclists in the city to get together and to try to reclaim the road. I think maybe that's really where critical mass started because, you know, as late as the 1980s, you know, with a few exceptions, I know back in the 70s, I think Mayor Koch tried to start bike lanes in New York City. Which didn't last long, but you know, it's really now that people are rediscovering the value of the bicycle as an urban vehicle. You're seeing a lot more, I think, progress and getting cyclists together.
We have a question from the audience. Give your name and where you're from, please.
I'm Ryan. I'm from Providence, Rhode Island, and. How does critical mass fit into a broader history of American protest? What other sort of movements was it aligned with when it got started? Where did it get its tactics from? And then also, how has it changed over the 20 years of its existence? And you know, what have those changes done to its sort of alignment? And how effective do you think it's been?
Zach?
I mean, the way that it's changed over the years, I can't give you the definitive answer to that. I know that as far as the shape of the ride, the way that it fits into a context, though, in terms of cycling, I think it's part of what has pushed the agenda for people to have room to be able to talk about bicycling in a way that's serious. In some places, it's caused like some negative feedback, but in a lot of places, it's actually really opened up room for people that do bike advocacy to do their work. To actually make, you know, like, remember interviewing a woman years ago who just said, you know, where I lived, it used to be that bike lanes were radical, and now they're not.
Hi, I'm Mark Levitt, and you're listening to Action Speaks, Underappreciated 20th Century Dates That Changed America. You can friend, comment on our topics we're exploring, check out our show's archives, all on our website, actionspeaksradio.org. There you can also listen to an interview with Chris Carlson, founder of Critical Mass, and read an essay that Chris wrote especially for this show. That's actionspeaksradio.org, and you can also follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. When we come back, we're going to explore further the nature of the protest that is critical mass and how it's influenced protests in the United States and around the world in the last 20 years. Hi, and welcome back. I'm Mark Levitt, and today on Action Speaks, we're examining Critical Mass, celebrating its 20th anniversary last month and still going strong nationally and globally as it continues to provoke questions about oil-dependent transportation and how the city can be organized to support the bicycle, not just as recreation, but as genuine transportation alternative. Our media sponsors are our host radio station, WGBH Boston, the Providence Phoenix, and Rhode Island Public TV. Our guests today are Nicole Friedman, former competitive cyclist and Boston's well-regarded former bike czar, or Serena, as she likes to refer to herself as. David V. Herlihy, author of Bike, A Wonderful History of the Bicycle, and Zach Furnest, assistant professor of communications, Penn State, Greater Allegheny, and the author of the fascinating and provocative One Less Car, Bicycling, and the Politics of Automobility. When we took a break, we were talking about the history of critical mass and its effect on protest. Critical mass, in some ways, ushered in a whole new kind of protest in the United States, a protest that we saw replicated again in the WTO demonstrations in Seattle. It was a type of protest that evolved, in my opinion, and I'm curious about yours, from Seabrook way back, that had a group of people rather than one strong individual, like when I was in college, deciding on the actions of the many. Is that accurate depiction of critical mass? And if so, what are the implications of that kind of non-hierarchical kind of protest?
I think someone like Chris Carlson, I think, really speaks to this very well. I mean, as one of the co-founders, he and somebody who constantly emphasizes the fact that he is a co-founder and not somebody who invented it, but is, in fact, about 50 other people, you know, all sort of collaborated on the idea. And I think part of it was to try to model the very thing that you're offering a critique of. So if your critique is that, you know, you don't like the fact that we live in an environment that's dominated by cars and it closes off all these possibilities, try to make those possibilities happen.
So to take the, from their point of view, to take the joylessness of the rush hour and make it instead a collective party.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
A way in which you basically take over the streets and use them for appropriate them for something else than they're used already. Is that, that would be a way to look at
it?
Yeah,
and I think that some of the ways that, that people do that is to literally, you know, use that as a place to harp on an issue and to talk about things. Like there were rides that people did that were very explicitly against entering into the first Gulf War or participating in the war in Iraq.
But for critical mass's point of view, just by the fact that you are asserting the right to the city is itself political.
I would argue so, and I think that a lot of other people would as well.
And the,
do you see a parallel with maybe the Occupy movement in the sense that it's...
I think that with that and a lot of the Seabrook as well, I think that the history of people who are influenced by anarchist ideals in a way that's not about anarchism as chaos, but anarchism as the distribution of power. I think that the idea being that you shouldn't have to be a specialist in, you know, political theory to know that something's wrong and to try to do something about it, and that should be a process that's inviting at the same time that it is radical.
Question from the audience: name and where you're from, please.
Sure, I'm John from Providence, and in the beginning of critical mass in San Francisco, New York, for the last two decades, there has been a lot of actual fights between either drivers or police in like trying to shut down the rides for not obeying the laws or other users of the road getting upset at it. And some people would argue that's gotten better as there have been structural, infrastructural changes. And I guess what I'm asking is, how is this still like a very physical fight?
I don't know. I mean, I think that there's been a lot of... the violence is in some ways overshadowed, I think, a lot of the many other rides that haven't had problems. But I do think... I mean, it's a good question, and it's not one I think can get a really easy answer, because I think context is really important for why people even have the rides in the first place. Like, I've talked to a lot of people who, you know, used to do advocacy work in places like Oregon 15 years ago, and they're sort of make the argument like, look, we don't need it. We don't need critical mass. Like, it's not, it served a purpose at a time in the same way in San Francisco, but it's just not, it's not necessary, and it's more...
Nicole, I want to ask you, but before we go further, I'm sorry, Zach.
No, please.
In Boston, you must have had to understand and participate with, whatever, or know that it was happening, critical mass. Am I right?
Yes and no. In Boston, in the professional world of bike planning in the cities, critical mass is not really on the radar. If it is about bicycle advocacy, there are much, much more effective ways to do it. Advocacy that works is showing up for the public meetings. It's meeting with the elected officials. It's coming to major events. You know, in all the conferences I've gone to with other city and state planners, critical mass has never been a topic.
People haven't even mentioned it amongst other sustainability planners, bike planners in other cities. They haven't even mentioned the fact that they've had critical mass demonstrations within their own midst, huh?
No.
Wow, it's not even a topic of conversation. I had no idea. David, does that surprise you?
Well, yeah, maybe not the Boston part of it, but living in Boston. I don't think critical mass has had the kind of participation, as far as I know, as or the history, say, as in San Francisco. But maybe rather than, say, do away with it or no need for it, as some of your friends said, maybe it could just evolve and be more of the celebration part of it. Are they becoming less confrontational? That generally speaking, that they're becoming less confrontational?
I think so. I think, like, particularly in the last, a good 10 years ago, I think you had a lot of confrontations, more so with, depending on where it was, with drivers and cyclists, but also a lot of times with police. Mm-hmm. And I think that the police have, partly because of court cases in New York where they've had to pay out millions of dollars for doing really, really stupid things as far as their engagement with the cyclists go. And this, you know, this isn't to say that, like, no cyclists have ever done anything dumb, but rather as a set of policies that they've done some really, really...
They've wisened up. They've learned to handle
it. So I think part of it's that. And then in other places, they just haven't really... There never was that kind of antagonistic relationship with the police. Whereas, like, people that I know were in Portland where they kept secret files on all the... on all the riders there, and they had to, you know, use freedom of information requests to actually get access to those. And so it really does vary considerably. But I think that, yeah, in a lot of places it's gotten less aggro as far as some of the people who show up, and also in terms of the way that can potentially turn into an argument or an altercation.
Actually, Chris Carlson, in the interview that you can hear on www.actionspeaksradio.org, talks about this latest 20th anniversary critical mass, and he said there was no problems with police at all. Question from the audience, name and where you're from?
I'm Sue Ellen from Providence. This all builds up on the questions that have just been asked about how critical mass has changed when I first started participating in Providence. There was like about 80 to 100 people that would show up, and it was very swarm-like mentality. It didn't matter. There weren't the same people there every week. We had cops that were on detail that would guide us and just follow. Not, they weren't leading us, but they would just go as we were going around the city. And I think something that needs to be mentioned in here is the influence of the policies that came out of the attack of September 11th, because that all of a sudden turned bicyclists into terrorists. And if you were participating in critical mass, then the first critical mass after September 11th, several people got arrested, and that it changed. It was a game changer, I think. So,
yeah, I mean, for those who are maybe thinking that's an outrageous statement to make about the terrorist thing, there's actually quite a number of places where bicyclists were sort of thought about in that way. I mean, the RAND Corporation has a chapter devoted to critical mass in one of their books, analyzing potential terrorist threats, drawing comparisons between sort of cells of groups of people who don't know each other all participating, as if there's like any remote correlation between the two, which of course there's not. But the idea that this is threatening in some way, that this is like a threat to people's safety, and which is patently ridiculous, but. If you're talking about safety in terms of how people ride and, like, their dynamic on the street, that's a very different thing than talking about, like, public safety is, like, what are the cyclists going to do,
Another question from the audience?
My concern is more when we don't have a critical mass. Providence is, relative to the cities you're from, is a small town. And people are very dependent. There's not public transportation, and they live in the outlying towns and small areas. So I'm curious whether you have examples of smaller, I will say smaller towns, where a small city, where the bicycling has been able to spread out and actually attract the people where they live, which is actually out in the urban, suburban sprawl.
Nicole, what have you noticed as you've gone on these conferences and talked on the phone?
Actually, it's interesting. If you look at the League of American Bicyclists list of bicycle-friendly communities, the sweet spot is actually these small to mid-sized cities, because it takes much less time to change culture and to change a city. So you look at cities like Bend, Oregon, I think that's under 100,000 population. Minneapolis, St. Paul, that's actually probably
Davis
pretty high.
Davis would probably be. Davis, California
Davis
was one of the...
Davis has always been one of the biggest. Palo Alto, San Luis Obispo, California, out east. This one is really ripe to be a fantastic bike city. One thing you guys have that out west doesn't have is your city itself is really dense. The vast majority of bike trips made are 1 to 2 miles. The commute trip, meaning getting from work to getting to home, is the hardest trip, but the average driver makes 7 trips per day. So you don't need to necessarily knock off that trip. But if you can get the trip to the bank, to the library, to everywhere else, you're doing great. Knock off 5 of the 7 and you'll be a fantastic bike city.
2 more questions.
Madison, Wisconsin. Let me add that one too. That's a good model for you.
Hi, I'm Danny. I live in Providence. I'm wondering if you guys can address issues of race, gender, and class in a bicycle movement. How do divisions along those categories show up?
I don't think you can ever talk about things like transportation without thinking about things like race and gender and class. And part of it is because, I mean, particularly when it comes to class issues, whether people have the ability to ride and whether we even talk about it as choice or not, I think is a really important thing. And I think that you can be like a young group of predominantly white folks that get together and clog up streets on a Friday once a month, and that's probably not going to raise the same issue as if you were like all Arabs, or if you are all people of color out on the roads. Like, you got some serious different issues that you're going to have to deal with on the streets. There's no like driving while white, you know, like you don't have that same kind of problems when it comes to public mobility.
Nicole, in the position, the political position and the politically sensitive position you were in, how did you deal with issues of gender, quote, race, and I put these in quotes, and class?
I love the question. And right from the beginning, our mayor said, we are going to make cycling equitable, and we're going to be the equity leader in cycling. And community bike programs, for us, we looked at low-income neighborhoods, and we said, well, what are the issues? Number one was access to bicycles. Number two, if you had a bike, there was nowhere to get it repaired. So we said, let's do that. We created a program, Roll It Forward, that gave away over 1,000 bikes to low-income kids, mostly kids that lived in public housing. And then we had bike repair mobile shops at all the farmers markets in the neighborhoods doing free bike repairs. That's fixed over 1,000 bikes. One of the reasons Paris had such a huge theft problem that many of you have heard about, they claimed there was 80% theft vandalism rate. A lot of it was some equity issues, that the bikes were not located in lower income neighborhoods. So right from the beginning, Boston and the other U.S. cities are locating the stations in low income neighborhoods. And you know what? Contrary to what everyone's biggest fear was, they're not getting vandalized any more than any other stations. And in fact, they're well-used stations.
Take one more question.
Hi, I'm Tom. I'm from Scranton, Pennsylvania. You know, I ride a bike and I drive a car, and I've also been hit by a car while riding my bike. But still, when I drive my car, I get frustrated by cyclists because neither of us know what to do with each other. So even with the bike lane, it seems like there still needs to be education on both sides about a kind of a standard protocol. Like, you know, critical mass has now encouraged all the building of this infrastructure that allows people to even get on a bike. But, you know, what about the kind of protocol that people need to learn?
How'd you deal with that, with the dance, the choreography of all the bicyclists in the bicycle lanes?
Education is a challenge. Number one, though, good design breeds good behavior. When something is designed well, it's really telling people how to move appropriately. Two is safety in numbers. So as you get more cyclists out there, the cars are more likely to expect the cyclists. The cyclists are more likely to follow the rules of the road and behave appropriately, and everyone seems to get it. Three, you can do traditional education measures. in Boston, as in many other cities, you take advantage of the excise tax mailing so we can mail safety brochures to every single driver. That's only so effective. And then you can also use mass media campaigns. I would say that's the farthest down the line. In Copenhagen, they train every single kid in how to bike. It takes generations. Boston's doing the same thing now, so they're working with 3,000-4,000 kids a year. You see the results later, though.
Last question.
I have to use this metaphor, for as ridiculous as it is, but I'm imagining the automobile as the lion. I'm imagining the bicyclist as the gazelle. And what happens when the lion is threatening the gazelle? They herd and they run. You know, so I just couldn't resist. Sorry.
I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like. You say black, I say white.
Today, we've been speaking about the first critical mass ride 20 years ago in the rush hour traffic of San Francisco, and how it opened up questions globally about transportation and urban planning choices, as well as how protests could be organized to achieve maximum results. Our panelists tonight have been Nicole Friedman, former competitive cyclist and Boston's well-regarded bike czar, or czarina; David V. Herlihy, author of Bike, A Wonderful, Wonderful History of the Bicycle; and Zach Furness, Assistant Professor of Communications, Penn State, Greater Allegheny, and the author of the fascinating and provocative One Less Car, Bicycling and the Politics of Automobility. Thanks as well to AS220, to the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Rhode Island Council for the Humanities, the law firm of Robinson & Cole, LLP, our presenting radio station, WGBH Boston. We thank as well the Providence Phoenix and Rhode Island Public TV. Check out the schedule for Rhode Island PBS's accompanying films on our website, actionspeaksradio.org. Thanks as well to my co-executive producer, Bert Krenker, our facilitating producer, Natalie Jablonski, our senior radio producer, James Moses, webmaster and photographer, Vera Levitt, our house manager, Merrily Armstrong, production manager, Zach Drummond, and Nick Solicito. I'm Mark Levitt, wishing you health, happiness, and as much surprise as you need, and a little more than you think you can handle. Thank you all.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd Avenue, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. This program was also made possible in part by a grant from Artemis Foods, Portland's local organic and sustainable catering company since 2001. Special events, corporate and wedding catering with seasonal menus and service supported by sustainable business operations. They offer full service and drop-off catering. Information by phone or through their website, www.artemisfoods.com. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis and Albany. The time is 11:54. Coming up at 12 o'clock is Jazz Lives with your host, Nick Geffro.
This song speaks of the Festival Express, a train and series of concerts traveling across Canada in the summer of 1970 featuring the Grateful Dead, Janis Joplin, Delaney and Bonnie, and many more artists. Come see the film Festival Express Thursday, March 14th at the Clinton Street Theater at this month's KBOO Radio Pictures screening. All ticket sales benefit KBOO Radio and may be purchased now via our website, kboo.fm. Plus, we'll have another short film and a trivia contest for you to match wits with the hosts of KBOO's Grateful Dead and Friends program. That's Festival Express, Thursday the 14th at the Clinton Street Theater. Details and tickets available now at kboo.fm. Well,
This is KBOO News at noon.
Oregon legislators are proposing two bills today that will either impose a fee for using studded tires or require drivers to buy a permit to use these tires. These bills will be presented to the House Transportation Committee this afternoon. A spokesman for the Oregon Department of Transportation claims that studded tires take chunks out of our roads, costing $40 to $50 million worth of damage each year.
Seattle public school teachers have launched a campaign challenging the overuse of standardized testing in public schools. They are taking particular aim at the Measures of Academic Performance, or MAP, test, which is administered several times each year. The teachers are calling for a boycott of the tests and have received support from a variety of sources, including the American Federation of Teachers. Dozens of high schools in Portland have also boycotted mandatory state tests.
The bill requiring Portland employers to provide up to 40 hours of sick leave annually will head to a vote at the City Council later this month. A change to the bill will specify that new employees cannot start using the sick leave until after 90 days on the job. A public hearing on the issue will be held at the Portland City Council tomorrow at 3 p.m., and the vote is scheduled for the next week.
The Oregon Small Business Association is trying to stop what they call surprise taxes by requiring all local tax increases to be subject to a vote by citizens. The action is aimed at mandates such as the controversial sick leave proposal and other tax and fee increases. The group was formed by conservative activist Jason Williams, who also co-founded the Taxpayer Association of Oregon, a group which has ties to the controversial organization known as ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council.
Confusion has arisen over the endgame for U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta said reports that 8,000 to 10,000 U.S. troops would remain in Afghanistan after 2014 are inaccurate. He points out that recent discussions with NATO partners focused on a range of options post-2014, and the numbers discussed also included contributions from other countries.
Several large corporations, including the Oregon-based Nike, are asking the Supreme Court to support gay marriage. Nike was among the first corporation to support Washington State's gay marriage bill. The company also recently held a major symposium focused on ending discrimination and harassment against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender athletes in public schools and colleges, as well as in recreational and professional sports. However, all of Nike's manufacturing facilities are in Indonesia, a country that has faced widespread criticism for discrimination against gay and lesbian Indonesians. This is Diane Erickson and Patrick Wilson with KBOO Noon News. Tune in every evening at 5 o'clock for more local, national, and international news. KBOO, Portland, Oregon. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM in Hood River and the Gorge, 100.7 FM in Corvallis and Albany, and around the world at KBOO.FM. It's time for Jazz Lives, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Mon Key, presenting Tony Bennett in concert this June at Edgefield. Tony Bennett tickets available now. Also presenting Steve Miller and Pink Martini and more this summer. Tickets and info at edgefieldconcerts.com. Thank you.
Thank you.